From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Wisconsin has transformed politically over the last decade, but some things haven't entirely changed.
Even Governor Walker claimed that Act 10 was a progressive reform. He used that word because it does have a salience in Wisconsin beyond party identity.
Then, to honor the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, a Frenchman restores a 1918 Harley-Davidson, brings it to the U.S., and rides it to Milwaukee.
If you are in France, you see a lot of people ride Harley-Davidson. It's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture. And I think Harley-Davidson brings this American culture all over the world.
We'll meet some women pursuing their American rock and roll dreams.
And we'll learn why Wisconsin high schools will no longer play baseball in the summer. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The last 8 years have represented a sea change in the Wisconsin political environment. The election of Scott Walker as governor in 2010 ushered in an era of Republican dominance at many levels, including the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump won Wisconsin, a result that surprised many national political observers.
The story of Wisconsin's transformation is a familiar one to people who live in the state, but writer Dan Kaufman believes it's one that holds relevance to people in the rest of the country. Kaufman is a Madison native who now lives in Brooklyn and has written for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, and Dan Kaufman joins us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So as you said about telling the story of Wisconsin's political transformation to a national audience, what was the biggest misconception you encountered about what people thought they knew about this state's story?
It's hard to say if there was any one single thing. I think what it told us is how this effort by conservatives to transform Wisconsin's politics, but also in doing so to transform the country's politics, was happening kind of through a thousand cuts. There was obviously the big battle of Act 10, which is probably the most significant and most defining. But there were many other things that were being done at this time to kind of, in my view, turn the state over to outside interests, not the citizens. It had a progressive past, a very strong and important one. It had also voted for Joe McCarthy twice. As people know, George Wallace, the Alabama segregationist governor, got his first real political start in Milwaukee.
Right. So was there always this kind of undercurrent of discord?
There was different strands, like most American states and cities. That said, it offered the country a kind of model that was unusual. I will give you a few examples. The whole kind of idea of social insurance sort of pretty much came out of the University of Wisconsin at the turn of the century. It became, some people say that most of the New Deal was actually drafted originally in Wisconsin and then was nationalized. The author of the Social Security Act was a man named Edwin Witte, and he, as well as a few other Wisconsinites and some other people, but he was the main driver of it, and he was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, these kind of pragmatic, progressive reforms that made life better for the majority of the state's citizens, and then, by extension, the country's citizens. The idea that a company had to have some responsibility for a worker being killed on the job. These were things that were real problems 110 years ago. And these reforms lasted and persisted. The idea of collective bargaining wasn't invented in Wisconsin, but it was the first state to grant collective bargaining rights to municipal workers in 1959 and then extended to state workers. This was by a Republican governor.
I was just going
to
say, I gather that this was really not a partisan issue. A lot of these weren't. The progressive name that we associate with progressivism, the La Follettes, were at one point Republicans.
They were Republicans, very much so. The state was thoroughly Republican. The Republican Party was founded here in a one-room schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. Now, there was a split, and eventually Bob La Follette, whom you mentioned, formed his own party, a progressive party. But But the idea that you mention is really true. And you can even see it. Even Governor Walker claimed that Act 10 was a progressive reform. He used that word because it does have a salience in Wisconsin beyond party identity. Now, that has eroded. That's true. But I would say that if I was really struck that he still continued to use that word to describe something that none of the progressives of the previous century would argue was progressive at all. So.
A lot of this all kind of starts, at least reaches kind of the national radar in 2010. You describe the situation today as Wisconsin being kind of like a living laboratory for conservative reforms. What did conservatives on a national scale see in Wisconsin in, 2008, 2009, 2010 that made the time right for this transformation to start?
Well, you had the financial crisis, and accompanying that was the rise of the Tea Party. And they wanted to impose, libertarian Republicans, conservative Republicans have long railed against the federal government. They don't see a role for it in social programs, or at least a very marginal role. And you can see that in people like Paul Ryan, whose intellectual hero is Ayn Rand, who basically thought that this created a culture of dependency and that people should be completely consumed with their individualistic goals. That was very antithetical to the Wisconsin of the past. I think what you had in 2010 was a Tea Party wave. And Scott Walker, like many other aspiring Republicans, was almost auditioning for a role with some powerful donors, Charles and David Koch, the Bradley Foundation, who is in Milwaukee and had been a supporter of his efforts as Milwaukee County Executive, as many, I'm sure all of your listeners know. I think what you had is him creating a blueprint, particularly for attacking labor. He went further than most. And it was replicated by many places, even recently in 2017. It continues to be replicated. For example, in Iowa, they passed a very extreme version of Act 10 that even included police and fire departments. This has transformed the electorate to some degree. It has atomized the state's population. The labor movement has had problems over the years. There's been racism. There's been corruption. But it also has served an important role as a counterweight to this infrastructure of business interests and so on. And it was clearly, Act 10 was clearly a political attack, as well as everything else that Walker purported it to be.
Do you think, was there a general frustration among some with the strength of labor unions, or did Act 10 and the climate around it sort of create this general frustration?
My view is that it stoked resentment in a time of economic insecurity. Some of those feelings may have been there, but also this economic insecurity, particularly in rural areas, was decades long. You have to look at the state. For example, there were 150,000 dairy farmers in Wisconsin after the Second World War. There are now fewer than 9,000. A lot of these rural communities have been depleted. Same time, we're producing the same amount of milk as we used to. So people, these communities are hurting. Sometimes the only people that might have health insurance in a small town, people that work for the school, the city workers or public workers. And so there was a lot of anger and Walker deliberately stoked this anger. And it was telegraphed in his inaugural address. He said the taxpayers can no longer be the have-nots and the public workers, the haves. So he was clearly engendering this rather than saying, oh, maybe we should try to work on getting health insurance for everyone.
Right. There was nothing in that speech to say, well, maybe everyone should be the haves.
Exactly. Which would have been more, I would argue, in the spirit of the state's progressive tradition of Bob La Follette, which was essentially trying to help lifting everyone up rather than pitting people against each other. And Walker, famously, as most of your listeners probably know, telegraphed his strategy to his billionaire donor, Diane Hendricks, probably his most important backer, in a private conversation captured by a filmmaker named Brad Lichtenstein, who said, she asked, when will Wisconsin become a completely red state? When will we become right to work? She conflated the two, and they are related. You know, as labor gets eroded, its strength, the Democratic Party gets weakened, and a state tends to become more Republican. A recent study showed that right-to-work states correlate to a 3.5% drop in Democratic turnout and voting. So, and he said to her, you know, we are going to use divide and conquer. You know, first we're going to attack the collective bargaining rights of public workers. And then, of course, 4 years later, he signed a right-to-work law.
Well, and so then when we flash forward to 2016, what did Hillary Clinton miss here? Why did the Clinton campaign not make more effort in this state? Was it just, you know, looking at historical voting patterns?
I think they definitely missed something. I think there was an overconfidence, a hubris, if you will, about Wisconsin. And even though it had voted blue, you know, for example, in 2004, John Kerry narrowly won it. There's a lot of things I go into in the book about that. I think there was a combination of factors. I think the state's Democrats tend to be probably to the left of the National Democrats. You saw that in the Act 10 protests. This was really the first mass grassroots political action from the left in a long time. And it was very there were huge numbers of people that sparked a kind of rethinking. At the same time, National Democrats did not really support these efforts. President Barack Obama did not come to Wisconsin to defend collective bargaining rights, and he wouldn't even make a brief stop for Tom Barrett when he was running the recall campaign. Now, Hillary Clinton, I think her record with labor was very difficult for her to sell. She was a former corporate board member of Walmart, as well as a longtime supporter of free trade agreements that have really hollowed out a lot of Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin's industrial base. And these issues have a huge salience across the industrial Midwest. And I think that resonated. People forget, too, that Donald Trump, in his speeches, which were marked by racial resentment and nativism, also defended the welfare state. He said, we will not, you know, Ted Cruz is going to cut Social Security. I'm going to defend it. Medicare. He also railed against NAFTA and these other agreements. So I think he was successful in Clinton's absence of peeling off a portion of the white working class.
So Wisconsin is where you grew up. In doing the reporting for this book, do you think there were fundamental things that you maybe didn't realize about your fellow Wisconsinites when you were growing up here?
Yes. I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm always interested in learning, and I learned a lot. I was reporting for 7 years, really, although the book really began in earnest after Trump's victory. But I'd written a lot of articles about the state's political battles in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And I learned so much about Milwaukee, labor history, the state, you know, the Bayview Massacre, things like this, as well as the environmental traditions, particularly among the indigenous communities. I spent a lot of time up in the Bad River Reservation. It was a very enlightening experience for me to see their perspective, which I knew about, but I had never, you know, spent extensive time with them. So, yes, I did learn a lot. I learned also about the state's, you know, ability to be mercurial, as we mentioned. You know, it can vote the other way. At the same time, I do think there were certain fundamentals that have been changed. Maybe, I never want to say permanently, but there was the idea that citizens should be encouraged to vote. That was a bipartisan note. The state used to have one of the most liberal voter registration policies. It was encouraged. Citizens should be participants. This was a legacy of Bob La Follette, who really encouraged active citizenship. And that was, both sides accepted that. Environmentalism, that was really a bipartisan tradition. Tommy Thompson preserved a lot of natural lands. And there were other things that seemed out of character. And I think that that is because there were these outside interests. It wasn't really driven by the state's citizens, certainly not the majority of them. But there was a receptive audience because things had been eroded for a time. That's my view. And there were some wealthy Wisconsinites, but there was also these out-of-state groups like, and I detail this in my book, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a very important group in transforming states. They propagate model bills that privatize education, strip away environmental regulations. They do things piecemeal, so you might not notice it. But after 40 years, if you look back, you can see, wow, we've really come a long way towards giving corporations the right to determine our environmental policy. In Wisconsin, that was extreme with this mining battle that happened in the Bad River when a mining company basically wrote part of a law that would give them what they wanted. And that idea that the citizen, the representative, isn't actually drafting it seemed antithetical.
If this blueprint kind of made itself visible, you know, this conservative blueprint made itself apparent as you looked into this, at the same time, were you left with any kind of a blueprint that progressives might look at for having the pendulum swing back the other way?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Wisconsin had been that laboratory of democracy. This is Justice Louis Brandeis's famous phrase, and he was really thinking of Wisconsin. For a long time, you know, when they passed the workers' compensation law here, it was modeled in many other states because it had been successfully. And there were a lot of times court challenges to these progressive reforms. And Wisconsin, very skillfully, using the expertise of the university, the kind of the heart of the Wisconsin idea, crafted very, very well-wrought legislation that withstood a lot of these court challenges. And then they became the template. So, I mean, I don't see that right now, but I do think that if progressives and, again, I'm a journalist, but if progressives wanted to look at Wisconsin's past, also the pragmatic reformist tradition of Milwaukee socialism, which was basically trying to invest in the public sphere, libraries, schools, the lakefront, the beautiful lakefront here, that is a legacy of these socialist mayors. And I think these kinds of things could be modeled. And you see them, in a sense, some of the movement of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Randy Bryce or Senator Bernie Sanders. There has been a revival for public investment, for the public sphere. Whether it can be successful politically, I don't know, partly because, you know, the labor movement is very much weakened. And that was kind of a very powerful force in American life. Beyond just labor, for example, the civil rights movement, it really was dependent on the help of labor.
Well, Dan Kaufman, remarkable job in showing Wisconsin to itself here.
Well, it's just, it's been great talking to you, Mitch, and I'm glad to bring the book here. I'm anxious for people to read it in the place where these stories were forged. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dan Kaufman grew up in Wisconsin. He now lives in New York. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion, and the Future of American Politics. He was in town last week for a discussion at Boswell Book Company.
A quick break now, and then we'll meet a Frenchman who is writing a piece of American history around the country this summer. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The summer road trip is an important part of the American ethos. It's a key part of American movies, from Easy Rider to National Lampoon's Vacation, and many of us have memories of our own road trips when we were kids.
While Europeans don't necessarily pack up their cars and drive across France or Italy or Poland, many of them do dream of their own great American road trip. And Frenchman Christophe de Goulain found the perfect vehicle to make that dream a reality.
De Goulain and his friend Pierre Lauvergiat restored a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle they found in France and brought it to the United States for a months-long road trip to commemorate the end of World War I. I met up with de Goulain at the Harley-Davidson Museum recently, and he shared the journey of the motorcycle and its sidecar.
Well, it's an incredible story because this bike is 100 years old. This bike arrived in France in 1918 with an American soldier to liberate France and Europe. It has just spent 100 years in France, and for the first time, she's back in America, so it's her birthday. It's a very special day, especially being here in Milwaukee.
Do you have a general idea of where it spent the last 100 years since the end of World War I?
We do not know exactly where. I know I found it, it was a barn find 10 years ago. It was a fantastic day for me, the day I found her, but she was in a very poor condition. It needed 9 months' work to put it all together and make it safe to ride. And that's my friend Pierre Lauvergeat, who did all that job, and we are together touring around America.
You said it took quite a lot of work to get it into this condition. Had he or you ever done quite this extensive an amount of work on a motorcycle before?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to ride a vintage motorcycle, you need to know what's going on inside. They do break down, but they never let you on the side of the road for a long time. We had a lot of little breakdown all the way coming from Mobile, Alabama. Every time we could repair on the side of the road, or we had the help from Harley-Davidson people, the dealer, especially the one from Jacksonville, who have been helpful, and we stayed there 8 days.
I imagine Harley-Davidson was excited to hear about this project.
Yes, well, very much. I mean, Harley-Davidson is it's a huge company, motorcycle all around the world, people with this passion. And straight away, we had contact with the Harley-Davidson Museum. They said, well, what a fantastic thing. Will you be coming? Yes, we will be coming with the bike. Will it be on the road? Yes, we will ride the bike to Milwaukee.
The end of World War I was 100 years ago, and I think people in the United States know about World War I, but they probably don't appreciate just how alive that history still is in France. This is something that is everywhere you go in France.
Of course. I mean, the First World War is a human disaster. The end of this disaster is with the help of America. You have in France a lot of towns, cities, village where you have got American cemetery. We call this bike Bonnie. That's the name of a village where 1844 American soldier died. And it's a very, very strong emotion because when you see the dates on the white marble cross, you know, American soldier were young. They died for the freedom of a country which was not their country. So we have to respect that and never forget. So Bonnie is there to remember. And there is a lot of people who don't know about First World War and don't know about Second World War, but America was there to help us. And thank you, America.
Have you been getting a lot of questions about this bike as you've ridden it around the United States?
Well, it's incredible. If we stop in the middle of nowhere, 5 minutes later, someone stops. First, they say, do you need some help? Well, I appreciate that because it's not in every country. And then after they have the story and they think, well, it's incredible. And we are very, very proud as French Harley-Davidson fanatic to be riding this Harley-Davidson. It's just a dream. It's a lifetime road trip. We are now after a month's trip. We have another 2 months trip and we are going to California. It's a dream. I mean, we will never forget what's happening now in America.
Do you have a newer Harley-Davidson at home in France?
I've got two other Harley-Davidson, which are 1927 and 1929. But since I'm here, yes, I want to buy a brand new Harley-Davidson. I saw them. I've been riding them. They have got the same passion. Harley-Davidson stays Harley-Davidson, even if it's 115 years. It's incredible. I love Harley.
What is it that you know, Harley is an iconic American brand. What is it that, as a Frenchman, appealed so strongly to you about Harley-Davidson?
Well, if you are in France, you see A lot of people ride Harley-Davidson. That's like in all over the world. So it's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture. And I think Harley-Davidson brings this American culture all over the world. So we heard a lot of things about tax and things like that. So please, Harley-Davidson, please, Europe, don't put any tax on Harley-Davidson. We need them for happiness.
What was the process to get this bike to the United States from France? You can't just bring it on an airplane, I imagine.
No, that was very complicated. Repairing the Harley was complicated, but bringing it to America was complicated. We had the help from the Propeller Club, which are all over the world, in the sea world. We had then after the Airbus company, which allowed the bike to be in a ship between France and Mobile, Alabama. Then we had question of insurance, have it legal. We did all that, so it's possible. It's not easy, but I mean for Bonnie, it was important to do it. So there's no problem.
Were there any special permits that you had to obtain to be able to drive this on American roads?
It's an American motorcycle, so it was born in America, so it's absolutely legal in America. Just the insurance, which is very important. We had one company who did it.
It does not look very comfortable.
Yeah, well, it's not very comfortable, but you forget that by the pleasure of riding it. So, and we are also two riders, Pierre and I. The sidecar is very comfortable. But I mean, you don't care, you know. It's you cruise along, you know, small roads. You have a break. When you're tired, you know, or you just stop and you talk with people, and it's fine like this.
The idea of the road trip is a very important one to many Americans. Do French people have the same love for getting out on the open road?
Oh yes. I mean, especially for bikers, you know, or any biker likes to jump on his bike and go for a trip. So it's the same.
I have to ask, as I look at all of these other bikes, almost all of them have windshields. What is it like? How do you protect your face when you're spending that long a stretch on the road and you have nothing in front of your face?
Well, we have got the helmet, of course, but the speed, the usual speed of our motorcycle is 45 miles an hour. So the wind is just, there's no problem with the wind.
I feel like I should have you give me a tour of the bike, actually.
The bike is absolutely original. It had some paint put back on it. But here, if you see the saddle, the leather saddle, it's 100 years old, so we know that the American soldier sat on this saddle. Piston, cylinder, all the metalwork, the wheels, the spoke, the sidecar. This is all original, made in Milwaukee by Harley-Davidson. It's great. We have got a modern light here because we need the good efficient light in the night. And this is the only thing which is different. And we have got the two flags here in the front on the mudguard, flag of France and America. Here we have got, this is very important for us also, because we have the United States World War I Centennial Commission, who gave us all their help, their enthusiasm, and which are following us. We have got also the Mission Centenaire, which is for France. We have, of course, the
two spare tires,
this to cover the sidecar. This is very French. On the sidecar mudguards, we have the joueur de pétanque. So you can't see it on the radio, yeah. But the people who know what pétanque is in France will recognize that. Here we have got Daffy, our sponsor. We have got stickers. And of course, we have got the Harley-Davidson. Wherever we stop in a Harley-Davidson dealer, they give us a sticker and we put it on the sidecar, and we are very proud to tour then after with the sticker.
What has been the most memorable part of the trip so far for you?
I think arriving here in Milwaukee. I mean, we just arrived a quarter of an hour ago to see the Harley-Davidson Museum in front of me on the bike with Pierre. I mean, this is, that was the dream. So we are very, very happy.
Is it a little like a pilgrimage?
Yes, yes. No, it's, I mean, there's no word to say it. I would be able to talk about this in French for hours. In English, maybe it's more difficult, but it's a very, very strong emotion.
Joie de vivre.
Joie de vivre.
Well, merci beaucoup. Bon voyage.
Merci beaucoup et à bientôt. Et suivez-nous sur Twin Links so you can follow our trip on our Facebook page, which is called Twin Links.
Merci.
Merci.
Frenchman Christophe de Goulain is driving a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle around the United States to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. We spoke with him at the Harley-Davidson Museum last week.
You can see pictures of the bike and the sidecar and find a link to follow the journey at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. We'll take another short break, but when we return, we'll find out why some Milwaukee grown-ups are headed to summer camp this year. That's when Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Is there any teenage music fan who does not dream about shredding an electric guitar in front of an adoring audience? Those youthful rock and roll fantasies may become less viable as we age, but longtime dreams of rock and roll glory rarely disappear completely.
Ladies Rock Milwaukee gives aspiring female-identifying musicians the chance to chase those dreams, well, at least for a few days. Participants choose an instrument, they form a band, they write a song, and they perform on stage, all in the span of a 3-day weekend. Lake Effect's Lauren Keane spent some time at this summer's edition, and she met some of the people behind it and some of the aspiring musicians who saw the chance and took the risk.
Ladies Rock is the sister camp of Girls Rock Milwaukee, a week-long summer camp that teaches girls ages 8 through 16 the foundations of musicianship. Ladies Rock co-founder Mary Joy Hickey was inspired to work with Ladies Rock after watching a group of pint-sized rockers perform.
So I had gone to the showcase of the first Girls Rock, and I did not have any children, I didn't have any kids, but watching the showcase at Turner Hall, I was in tears. And I don't think I was alone in that. It was this very powerful experience. So I went home and I just cried some more about how I needed to get involved in that sort of organization. As a musician, prior to that, I had primarily been focused on my own pursuits. I hadn't really given back to the community in any meaningful way. I really didn't lend my growing expertise in any sort of mentorship way. And I think watching the first Girls Rock Showcase really kind of cracked something in me. It hit something, and I wanted to get connected.
And thus, Ladies Rock was born. Girls Rock is a week-long camp, but Ladies Rock organizers understand that adult women don't have that kind of time.
On Friday and Saturday of camp, campers come to a different location at UWM, and our goal is to teach them how to play an instrument, how to play an instrument with other people, in collaboration with other people, and then offer workshops that really stimulate them emotionally and intellectually, and to make this a holistic personal and professional growth experience.
Sarah Schaff is a first-time Ladies Rock camper, playing bass in a group called Anka Pop. She played clarinet throughout high school and college, but she never picked up a rock instrument until Ladies Rock. Many of the camp's participants make the point that the male-dominated music community can sometimes be intimidating to women. Schaff says Ladies Rock is the most welcoming environment possible.
It's almost nice to be in the limited space of only female-identifying people, because there's not that worry there of social expectation. And then a lot of these women who are volunteering or working with us either have bands of their own, have participated in Ladies Rock before, have performed before and had performance anxiety. So they've been in our shoes before. So just the fact that they've had to deal with similar problems that we're dealing with all in 2 days. They have a lot of really great wisdom and advice to give us, and they can give it to us in a way that's not judgy, that doesn't make us feel bad, that's very supportive and encouraging. Whereas if it were more of a mixed environment or people who haven't participated in an experience like this before, we might feel more self-conscious.
Ladies Rock volunteer Addie Skillman plays in an all-girl punk band called Red Lodge. Skillman is a Girls Rock Milwaukee organizer and acts as a band coach for Ladies Rock. Band coaches encourage camper creativity, and they get to watch the music-making magic happen firsthand.
There's so many of us who are local musicians. Myself, Mary, Molly, Audrey, Gabby, the list goes on. Like, it's so cool. I think I could speak for all of us to say that it's really awesome to be able to share our passion with new women and like spread the joy of like playing music. It's really great. And I think that campers enjoy it too.
Ladies Rock campers vary both in age and music experience level. Drummer Becca Siegel has played in bands before, but usually on vocals or strings. One thing Siegel loved about Ladies Rock was the opportunity to meet other beginner musicians.
I was talking with one of my bandmates, which sounds cool to say, about the fact that I'm always envious of bands that you hear forming because they grew up together, they met in college, and if you don't have access to a friend group like that, how do you meet other musicians that are at your level? It's a really great networking weekend to meet other musicians that are at your level or around it because they advertise it as no experience necessary, and that's really rare. It's a way to find a new community that otherwise wants it accessible to you.
A few campers decided to enroll in Ladies Rock because they were hitting certain milestones in their lives, including drummer Maria Schmidt.
Basically, I've always wanted to play drums ever since I was little, and I thought this was my chance. This is a big birthday year for me, so I thought it's time to do new things.
Can I ask what birthday year it is for you?
I'm turning 50 this year.
Schmidt was one of three campers hitting the big 5-0 in 2018. Bassist Jill Berry notes that women of a certain age tend to be viewed in a certain light.
In our society, women of our age, middle age, there's a lot of invisibility with regards to us. And so Ladies Rock is one of those opportunities that we can take to really kind of bust out and say, you know, hey, just because we're of a certain age doesn't mean that we can't do this and we can't rock and we're gonna rock.
61-year-old guitarist Sharon Lerman was the oldest camper this summer.
Well, I've always wanted to learn how to play guitar, and also I just love the idea of doing something really different than what I usually do, and playing music with people is awesome.
So you said you've always wanted to play guitar. Is there anything that was ever holding you back from doing it?
Yeah, I played clarinet in high school also, but it was because we had a clarinet in the house, and that's the instrument that we had. This time I get to choose the instrument, and I really love it.
Do you think that you would stick with playing guitar when you finish the camp?
Yeah, I just have to figure out how.
Even though the 3-day camp mostly focuses on music, many campers agree Ladies Rock provides a much-needed break from their usual stressors.
Sometimes people need to get away and they go to a spa weekend or something. I really think of this much better than that because not only am I learning something really amazing and I'm with people who are really incredible, but I am really being cared for here and supported, and that is the best spa I could imagine.
I absolutely agree with that. I know people who are like, oh, I'm going to the spa, I'm having a pedicure. I'm like, ick, there's nothing I would like less than that. So this has been awesome that way. And the fact that they have awesome snacks is super helpful too. And I find it much more of a stress reliever to like bang on drums than to be sitting in with, I don't know, cucumbers on my eyes or whatever it is you do.
Angela Mancuso appreciates the chance to take a break from work and focus on self-care.
What's nice is I haven't been obsessing about my job, which is a 24/7 job, and I feel like getting even a 3-day sort of mental break where I'm using a different part of my brain and learning something completely different. And so when I go back, I think I will feel refreshed, and I think that's so I think being allowed to express yourself and emote and create in a safe space when you don't have any experience is is really good professionally and personally.
For the camp's grand finale, each of the brand new bands perform their brand new songs in front of an adoring audience at Company Brewing. Many campers look forward to returning to Ladies Rock next summer for another fun-filled weekend. For Lake Effect, I'm Lauren Keane.
You can see photos and learn more about Ladies Rock Milwaukee at WUWM.com.
Lindsay Liu continues to pursue her own musical ambitions, but the native of Michigan's Upper Peninsula decided that Nashville, Tennessee was the place she needed to go to make them happen. Here she is in the Lake Effect Performance Studio with her song, Sugar.
Well, I've been living with lackluster conviction, thinking, speaking in contradiction, like a senator who lives to serve a holy man without the word. And I spent my last penny on that sugar. Oh, I've got that not to fight for your attention. When I'm in left field with an out of sight intention, in a game where I ain't keeping score, least of all when I want more. Yeah, I spent my last penny on that sugar. Yes, on that sugar.
Sugar.
That sugar. All mine, I don't need your kind of love, I just need my sugar, yeah. Yeah, give me that sugar.
Lindsay Liu performing Sugar earlier this summer in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Her new album is called Southland.
Wisconsin high school baseball players have been playing summer ball for generations, but that era has come to an end this month. We'll learn why baseball will be a spring high school sport from here on when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Although baseball here in Wisconsin starts as soon as the snow melts in the spring, it doesn't really heat up until summer. For many fans, baseball and summer go hand in hand, and high school baseball has been a summer staple here in Wisconsin for the past 54 years.
All that is coming to an end, though, as the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletics Association Board of Control voted this spring to end summer baseball and move all teams to spring, rather than giving them the choice of seasons.
Earlier this month, Capco Park in Mequon played host to the final WIAA Summer Baseball State Tournament. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi played high school baseball in Wisconsin a few years back. He caught up with the action in Mequon and tried to figure out what summer baseball means and why the move to spring is necessary.
Before the game, a representative from each of the 53 summer baseball champions from around Wisconsin lined up around the infield, holding their trophies to recognize the long history of summer baseball in the state. One of those champions, Scooter Green, from the little town of Alma, just south of Eau Claire, made the trip out to Mequon for the occasion.
I played in a state baseball tournament, championship game in 1971. We beat Hamilton Sussex 3-2 in a great ball game. A small school of 185 students up against a school with 2,000 students. It was a great time, a great experience, and I'm very happy to be invited back to watch the last state baseball championship.
The WIAA originally offered only spring baseball, but added summer baseball in 1965 to allow schools to offer additional spring sports. Green has a unique perspective, as Alma switched from spring to summer during his time there, so he played baseball in both seasons during his career.
Baseball and summertime go together. It's pretty hard not to go anywhere to see a baseball game, girls' softball game, Little League programs. Spring has some challenges, and we had to put up with the weather and the cold and oftentimes snow, but those are the challenges that they'll have, and I'm sure they'll do well with them.
I recently caught up with my old high school baseball coach at Homestead High, Ernie Millard, to ask him about the appeal of summer baseball and the upcoming change to spring ball.
I think summer baseball is kind of distinguished from almost all other sports in that it's the only high school sport going on that time of year. And I've always heard complaints about the potential for summer baseball to be difficult for kids because they have a lot going on. I've always found it to be the exact opposite. It's the one thing going on in a community in the summertime, and it tends to galvanize people and bring them together in a great environment.
Millard says he understands the reasons for the change, but as a longtime proponent of summer baseball, he also sees some drawbacks.
I think the pros are consistency for everyone, knowing when your seasons are. There's no overlap like there had been between spring and summer. Kids are going to be able to look and say what I was going to do in the summer, whether it's camps or traveling or things, that's not going to be inhibited for them. The negative is you're taking away an opportunity for kids who wanted to be four-sport athletes. There was a small group of them. The other negative is for me, the weather and the environment that we just talked about. It's really cool to go coach summer baseball, and so that'll be lost.
Certainly, summer baseball elicits nostalgia for many, but Wade Lebecki believes the change to spring will be a positive one. He's the deputy director of the WIAA.
The kids will find that they can go out for baseball and still work for college. And I think, that's one of the factors as well when you don't have a lot of seniors out. So you're going to see more seniors on the high school teams, I think, that they haven't traditionally seen. The second thing that I think you'll find is that the coaches are going to, while they may not like the weather in March, but they'll find that they have some more time to be with their families. It's a hard change, but I think in the end, they'll find it's not that difficult.
At its peak, summer baseball had around 120 teams in the 1990s, but the numbers have been dwindling ever since, mostly due to pressure from kids wanting to play with travel teams in the summer. The WIAA voted to make the change at the same time the pros were holding spring training.
In March, we had probably 30 left, probably had three more in the mail, so 27, and I knew eight more were going. So when the board made that decision, there were really actually only 19 schools still in summer baseball. So a lot of different factors went into those decisions, but the schools made the decisions, and once we had 19, there's no way we could host a tournament.
The long history of summer baseball championships has seen its share of exciting games, and the expectation for this year in Mequon was no different. The championship game featured Milwaukee Pious and Muskego. After a Muskego pitcher threw a no-hitter in the semifinals, fans were geared up for a pitcher's duel in the finals. Sure enough, the game remained scoreless through the first 7 innings and headed to extra innings. Pius plated a run in the top of the inning on a sacrifice fly. But Muskego answered with a double by Cooper Tamblyn, who advanced on a wild pitch and then scored on a perfectly executed suicide squeeze. With the game tied, 2 outs, and the bases empty, it looked like another extra inning was in store. But 2 consecutive walks put Muskego's Frankie Sestero up to bat with runners on first and second. Sestero hit a line drive up the middle, sending pinch runner Richard Wauer racing around third to score. And Muskego stormed the field, dogpiling around the mound as Pius's players fell to the ground in disbelief. And with that exciting finish, a storied chapter of baseball history in the state came to a close. For Lake Effect, I'm Ben Benversi at Capco Park in Mequon.
You can read more about the story at WUWM.com. And to keep the conversation going, you can share your own memories of summer high school baseball in Wisconsin at WUWM Radio on Facebook. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie Noor. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay with us because fresh air is next.